Because of Herod's building abilities, the temple and the city had never been more beautiful. And yet, society had become so violent that the religious leadership within it was unable to achieve what the temple had called it to seek. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 77. The Sanhedrin departs the temple. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Visitors to the Western Wall today can also avail themselves of a journey to the past utilizing technology that is futuristic in nature. Thus, the website kotel.org tells us, quote, "For the first time in Israel, you can take a tour of the Second Temple using advanced virtual reality technology. This 360-degree perspective lets you see the beauty of the temple that was destroyed approximately 2,000 years ago. During the visit, you will put on a special set of goggles that will take you back thousands of years in time and land you in the most important place for the Jewish nation, the temple. The specially designed seats will allow you to get a real sense of what the temple was like in all its glory. We recommend," the website continues, "combining the virtual reality tour with a visit to the Western Wall and the sites around it. This short experience is a perfect addition to your visit. Look into the past is now available in the following languages: Hebrew, English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Russian, Chinese, German, and Yiddish." End quote. I must say, ladies and gentlemen, that I have myself experienced this technology, and I enjoyed every minute of this tour into the past. To commune visually with the blueprint of the temple in virtual reality is a wonderful pedagogical use of technology, but the experience is also a metaphor for the fact that the temple was always kept alive in spiritual, vibrant, virtual reality in the minds and hearts of Jews throughout the centuries. And we too must for a moment look to the past and understand a bit about the blueprint of the temple as it stood in the first century CE. For only then can we truly appreciate how one move made by the Sanhedrin in that period tells us so much about the generation of Jerusalem and Judea in which it found itself. While the word Sanhedrin in rabbinic parlance often refers to the body that was the Supreme Court of the Jewish faith, that court was technically known as the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the Great Sanhedrin, which sat within the sacred precincts of the temple itself. There, its 71 sages were joined by three rows of students, potential future members of that Sanhedrin. But as the Talmud describes, there were smaller Sanhedrins, smaller Beth Dins, to utilize the Hebrew phrase for court. Near the Great Sanhedrin, at the door of the temple courtyard, and at the entrance to the Temple Mount. And there were also Sanhedrins throughout the land that were authorized to judge and to administer punishment. The role of the Great Sanhedrin in the temple was first and foremost to resolve questions of law that the lower courts could not resolve. It sat inside a chamber on the Temple Mount that was known as the Lishkat HaGazit, the Hall of Hewn Stone. Thus, the Talmud describes the role it played. Quote, and this is from the Sinsino Talmud, "It has been taught, Rabbi Yossi said, originally there were not many disputes in Israel, but one Beth Din of 71 members sat in the Hall of Hewn Stones, and two courts of 23 sat, one at the entrance of the Temple Mount and one at the door of the Temple Court. And other courts of 23 sat in all Jewish cities. If a matter of inquiry arose, the local Beth Din was consulted. If they had a tradition thereon, they stated it. If not, they went to the nearest Beth Din. If they had a tradition thereon, they stated it. If not, they went to the Beth Din situated at the entrance to the Temple Mount. If they had a tradition, they stated it. If not, they went to the one situated at the entrance of the court. And he who differed from his colleagues declared, 'Thus have I expounded, and thus have my colleagues expounded. Thus have I taught, and thus have they taught.' If they had a tradition thereon, they stated it, and if not, they all proceeded to the Hall of Hewn Stones." Thus, the Great Sanhedrin in the Hall of Hewn Stone presented the last word on all legal matters, either through unanimous agreement or, when necessary, through majority vote. Where was this edifice, the Hall of Hewn Stone? The answer is that it was directly north of the altar, inside an area that was called the Azara, or Sacred Courtyard. It seems to have been important for the Great Sanhedrin to be adjacent to the altar, near one of the holiest sites of the temple. So much so that an ingenious form of construction took place inside the Hall of Hewn Stone in order to synthesize sanctity and practicality. As described in the Talmud, half of the Sanhedrin chamber was situated within the altar area and considered, according to Jewish law, part of that very sacred sphere. Yet because of the sanctity of that area, sitting down within it was not allowed, and so the Hall of Hewn Stone was made in such a way that the other half of the chamber extended beyond the sacred altar space, wherein the Sanhedrin could actually sit. Why this complexity of construction? Why does it make sense to create a judicial chamber that is half within one of the holiest parts of the temple and half outside of it? The answer appears to be that, while the lengthy nature of adjudication required the members of the Great Sanhedrin to sit down, the court also needed to be as close as possible to the most sacred sections of the temple in order to reflect its need for divine assistance as it engaged some of the most controversial questions in Jewish law. As Rabbi Yitzchak Levy suggests, quote, "The role of the judges is to bring about the revelation of divine judgment in the fullest way. There is a connection between setting the Sanhedrin close to the altar and the statement that judgment belongs to God. Since judgment belongs to God, it is revealed in its ideal and supreme form only when the Sanhedrin sits in its designated place in the chamber of hewn stone near the altar," end quote. Here, ladies and gentlemen, we might refer to the famous Rye statement from United States Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who said about the United States Supreme Court something like, "We are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final." This may capture how some Supreme Court justices saw themselves in the United States, but the matter of the ancient Supreme Court of Jerusalem was a bit more complex. The judges of the Great Sanhedrin believed themselves to be fallible, so much so that one Talmudic tractate exists in order to describe, among other subjects, the atonement of the Sanhedrin if an egregious error occurs. And yet, precisely because of the finality of the Sanhedrin's decisions, the members of the Great Sanhedrin understood the profound responsibility weighing on them and believed that it was their closeness to the holy that could serve as a source of divine assistance in seeking legal truth. Thus does the Chamber of Hewn Stone allow us to compare the judges of the Great Sanhedrin with the members of the other two branches of Israelite leadership: the ritual representative of Israel known as Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and the Melech, the king. Regarding the high priest, Maimonides informs us that Ubayit yeh muchan b'mikdash, he had his own dwelling place in the temple, Ukvodo v'tifarto shiyeh yoshev tamid b'mikdash, and the high priest's honor lies in him always dwelling in the temple, V'lo yetze el beito bilvad, and he would only leave to go home. And, Maimonides adds, V'yeh beito b'Yerushalayim ve'eino zaz misham, the high priest's home should be in Jerusalem, from which he can never leave. In order to ensure the holiness of the high priest, he was meant to remain as close to the holiest sites in the temple as possible. Meanwhile, the king was called to lead his people far beyond the realm of the holy, engaging in war and politics. The king, in other words, often found himself far away from Jerusalem. Thus, the high priest was situated within the holy, and the king outside it. The Great Sanhedrin, in contrast to both, was situated in a room that was half extremely sacred and half slightly less so, with lower courts spread from the Temple Mount throughout the land, but looking back to the Great Sanhedrin for leadership. The Great Sanhedrin, in other words, was called to be the bridge between the holiest parts of the temple and the world at large. The precise positioning of the Hall of Hewn Stone reflects how judges were meant to connect the holy and mundane by applying their judgments and their disciplinary actions as well. It's with this in mind that we can understand the rabbinic dictum that the lesser Sanhedrins, the smaller courts situated throughout the land, were only authorized to mete out capital punishment when the Supreme Court of Jerusalem still sat in the Hall of Hewn Stone. Only when the judicial branch was linked to the holy the judges believe themselves capable of bridging sacred and society through punishment. This, in turn, allows us to analyze a dramatic moment recorded in the Talmud. 40 years before the temple's destruction, we are informed, the Sanhedrin saw such bloodshed increasing throughout Judea that it recognized its utter inability to check it, and it therefore chose to leave the Chamber of Hewn Stone, so that, from that point forward, no Jewish court in the land of Israel, small or large, could continue to impose capital punishment. This move perhaps reflected, as Rabbi Yitzchak Levy elaborates, the Sanhedrin's understanding of its inability in that generation to fulfill its role within the sacred site of the temple. Judea's fragmented social state, it would seem, can be traced back to the power vacuum left in the wake of Herod's death. At this point, various marauding rebel bands arose. As the historian Martin Goodman notes, this event set the stage for the rebellion against Rome that was yet to come, but it also allowed for real social fragmentation and violence of Jew against Jew, where, as Josephus put it, quote, And so Judea was filled with brigandage. Anyone might make himself king as the head of a band of rebels whom he fell in with, and then would press on to the destruction of the community, causing trouble to few Romans, and then only to a small degree, but bringing the greatest slaughter upon their own people. End quote. The departure of the Great Sanhedrin from the Chamber of Hewn Stone captures the paradox of the moment in 30 CE, with only 40 years of Second Temple Jerusalem left. Because of Herod's building abilities, the temple and the city had never been more beautiful. And yet, society had become so violent that the religious leadership within it was unable to achieve what the temple had called it to seek. And as we will see, it was violence between Jew and Jew that ultimately allowed for Jerusalem's defeat at the hands of the Romans, and of course, the burning of the temple that took place in the destruction. But as the Sanhedrin departed the temple as its permanent location, its members, of course, continued to worship there. And, as importantly, they bore the blueprint of the temple with them so that 2,000 years later, we could still point out exactly where in the vast temple complex the Hall of Hewn Stone sat and where the Sanhedrin sat within it. We can pinpoint as well almost every other chamber atop the Temple Mount, so much so that the temple can be conjured up today not only in vibrant virtual reality, but also in reading rabbinic texts throughout the centuries. No other civilization retained a relationship with a single edifice in the same way. And if the Sanhedrin's departure signified the beginning of the end of the Second Temple, it also marked how, in a certain sense, in the minds and hearts of rabbinic Jews, the temple would never disappear. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.